Case of the Frozen Pussy, Slip or Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will find on the Miami Memoirs podcast. Strange Cases and Wild Tales presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of a creative Florida attorney reaching out over 60 years. There's more than meets the eye. In these sparkling memoirs, Florida attorney Louis Ress uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful, and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. Before we begin, I would like to tell you about a new book from Louis. Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring, Round 2 from the Amazing Life and Times of Legendary South Florida Attorney Louis Ress, takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s, via a spell in a top-secret Army department, and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis, to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available on Amazon, just search Louis Ress. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. I'm Jeanette, your host, and today we're on episode 41, The Pink Dolphin. So Louis, here we go. What's the Pink Dolphin about? Are there really pink dolphins?
Jeanette Garcia, it's so good to be with you on this early Sunday morning to discuss Pink Dolphin. That should be the name of a bar, Purple Mermaid or the Pink Dolphin.
Very catchy.
It's like a dream. It's a mirage. That's what they say, oh, the Pink Dolphin. And they're all Pink Dolphin. It's true. And my wife found out about it. And she wanted my grandson's to see it. So there's little doubt that my grandson, Sean, was accepted at one of the most exclusive prep schools in the United States, based in substantial part upon his essay, which involved our trip to find the elusive pink dolphin. That was my wife's idea. It all began in Iquitos, Peru, when Grandma Esther, my wife, jumped from an airplane at age 66. She was a terrific runner. She ran 118 10-kilometer races and never lost one in her age group. If you had a horse like that, I wouldn't be sitting here with you. I'd be a rich man. So the horse would be in the world famous. But that's what she did. And she decided that her grandsons would see the freshwater river pink dolphin. So we had to go to Iquitos. Iquitos is the major upper Amazon river port in Peru. And there are no roads leading into it.
Oh, okay. So it's inland with no roads absolutely getting to it.
It's an inland city.
How'd you get there?
On a river. You can't get there by road. They don't have roads. So you have to fly into the airport, which has very sporadic service to Lima. Iquitos is a city of wrought iron colonial tiled buildings, and it's a residential town, and Belin is the residential area, and it consists of floating wooden shacks, which are on floats and which rise and fall in the river.
Oh, wow.
From, like, logs.
Huh. So it's pretty much like a floating
floating city. On the river, and okay. The river goes up and down. It doesn't stay at the same level all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire city goes up and down with it. Iquitos is an extremely unusual and worthwhile travel destination alone. The flea market has jaguar paws and monkey heads and live jungle creatures of every kind and description. And upriver and into the floodplains are where things get wild. Each day, the villages along the river become more and more primitive as you get away from Iquitos. The small river cruise boat that we were on heads to the confluence of the Apurimac and Montero rivers, way back towards the headwaters of the Amazon, which starts, nobody realizes, the Amazon starts in the Andes Mountains.
Hmm.
And
it's quite large, huh?
Oh, it's one of the largest rivers in the world, mm-hmm. if not the largest. I guess there's the Nile.
The Nile, yep.
And the Mississippi, some of the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a biggie, the Amazon. There's one point where you can't see across it
huh.
towards the mouth.
After 3 days of going upriver, confluence of the Apurimac and the Montero rivers is met. And one of the rivers is muddy, and the other one is absolutely crystal clear. And there is a distinct line where they merge. Hmm. You can see a brown line right through the water.
Okay, and then, so what happened next when you reached that point?
Well, the lecturer gets on the microphone, and he says, folks, the pink dolphin are air-breathing river-bottom feeders. Their soft cartilage enables their head to rotate so much that they can look up for air and then look down to feed from the river bottom. They don't have much of a dorsal fin, not like their ocean-going brothers and sisters. They are mammals, and they're very intelligent. Their brain is 40% larger than ours, and there are 5 species of river dolphin, but the pink dolphins are the smartest and the friendliest, and their pink color varies. You'll probably see gray ones with light pink bottoms all the way up to totally pink ones. Sometimes they work in a pod or a group to corral fish. Then they feed one at a time while the group keeps the bait fish assembled. Here they come now.
Was this the first time that you saw them? Because it sounds like a weird creature.
Yeah, I hadn't even heard of them. I didn't even know they existed until my wife read about them.
Wow.
I'll tell you, I've seen dolphin here, mm-hmm. by the way, do the same thing with bait fish, corral them.
Right, they work
so
in a group.
So it's typical of dolphin. They're very smart.
Mm-hmm.
Iquitos alone would have been enough to justify the trip. It's a very interesting city.
Mm-hmm.
It's Spanish colonial city. However, the pink dolphin were the main attraction. But neither were the subject of the essay that got Sean into St. Paul's prep school.
Are these endangered? Are these dolphins endangered?
Oh, yeah. What the guy didn't say, and I found out later, were that the pink dolphin are a highly endangered species, in part because they're being harassed by the tourists.
Mm, yeah.
The noise of the motors can cause disorientation and death. They have very sensitive hearing. The propellers can scar and mangle them. And then, of course, they have this development, so-called development, that the national government says is good for the economy, gold mining. Well, the gold miners pour mercury into the rivers. Then you have oil and gas exploration, and they destroy and they chop down the jungle, and agricultural expansion adds to the pollution. They want to make farms and graze cattle, and when you do that. We did that in the United States. We chopped down the first
growth. Chopped down all the trees.
All over
yeah,
the United States.
Everywhere.
So that's what they're doing there.
Wow.
And there's illegal logging. And if you have a certain type of tree, mahogany, you're finished. They'll kill you to get to the mahogany trees. Then there's drug trafficking. And it's a great spot to hide drugs and grow illegal drugs.
Hmm.
So Peru is the number 2 cocaine producer in the world.
Wow.
Did you know that?
No.
And that alone would have made an interesting essay.
Yeah.
And I'll talk to you more about that stuff. But it wasn't what Sean had to say. My grandson had something else to say.
Hmm. So I'm sure you'll tell us what Sean had to say. What happened after that?
Well, the boat continued upstream, and the riverbanks got closer and closer to one another. At the mouth of the Amazon, it's so wide that you can't see the other side. And all the way at the beginning, at the source, it becomes narrow.
Mm.
And you can easily go across.
Oh, okay.
We finally dropped anchor at a very small settlement on the edge of the river, with the settlement had its back to the jungle. And it consisted of about 20 little wooden houses. Each one was a wooden platform raised up about 3 feet from the ground to protect it against the flood tides. The sides, if any, went up for about 3 more feet, and then there was a gap of about 3 feet to a roof. Which was a beam of wood that supported a brown palm thatch roof. Pigs and chickens took shelter under the floor. They had floorboards. And our Zodiac raft touched shore, and we were greeted by the chief and his council. And we were escorted to the common house, which was in a clearing.
And did they have any other buildings?
There was a one-room schoolhouse and a storage house and a community building used for religious ceremonies, each faced onto a square. And the center square or center area was a hard-packed mixture of dirt, shells, and scrubby grass. And it was used for rituals and festivals. It was the common area. They used it to play football or soccer.
Did you get to see how they lived?
Yeah, we did. We were invited into a typical hut, which contained two rough wooden platform beds, a cane and wood chair, you know, the woven cane, a palm thatch, and a small table, and some open shelves for food and clothing. Just open shelves, planks of wood. The kitchen was a blank piece of wood with a wash basin, and it was scrubbed. The wood was scrubbed, and the wash basin sat on it, wasn't sunken into it, and there was no plumbing, none.
So they no sinks, showers, bathrooms, none of that?
Yeah, well, they all bathed in the river all together, and they only had a kerosene cooking stove and a wick lamp for light.
Wow.
And once it got dark, that was it. And the bathroom was a small enclosure about 15 yards behind the house. They had an outhouse. And the three children slept together in one bed, and the parents held hands, and the kids were standing behind their mother holding onto her skirt.
Oh, wow. What an image that you painted for us there. So what was Sean's essay about then?
Well, Sean's essay went along the following lines. He said, quote, "When we arrived at this primitive village, I noticed that everyone was smiling, grinning from ear to ear."
And why were they grinning?
Well, the parents were touching their kids. They were grinning because they were content. I think that's an animal expression, a smile or a grin, that shows contentment or happiness. And they often had their arms around the kids, and the children were holding on. It's a lot of touching. And there was no loud voices, except at the soccer match. Then they screamed. The affection that they had for one another was quite apparent, physically apparent, just like you can tell with animals, when they rub against you and touch you and smile and stroke you. They listened to one another, and they didn't interrupt each other. At school, all the students were paying attention. They took us in and showed us a class, and they all looked at the teacher. They didn't have any iPhones. There was no texting. There was no Wi-Fi. There was no TV, not even a radio, no electricity.
And what about cars, any vehicles, like?
I looked for an automobile. There were none. Well, where were the bicycles?
Oh, yeah.
There were none. There's no place to ride. There's no place, no roads. Just jungle and river. River and jungle.
Yeah, so there's no use for them.
And what about toys? They had no toys. The children all had pets from the jungle, including monkeys, parrots, macaws, sloths, and some weird marsupials with huge eyes. These little animals with huge eyes.
Oh.
And after they trounced our pickup team in soccer, we were shown their latest project. They had a huge tree trunk that they had chopped down this tree, and about 10 of the adults and some of the younger children were chipping away with hatchets. And they were also burning the interior of the tree, gradually carving a large dugout canoe.
And how did they communicate while they were doing this?
Well, we communicated.
Or how did you, yeah, how did you communicate?
They spoke a local dialect. We didn't speak it. And they spoke some broken English in school. They were learning. And they had a teacher, and they were learning. And we could see that the community worked together. And they made gestures to us. You can communicate with a little few words and some gestures, and they did. And they were all working together, sharing different tasks. They were building and maintaining the 20 houses. They all fished in the river as a team. If anyone was in need, they all shared. When there was enough extra food, they put it in a community storehouse. And the council, they had a council, and the council decided when and how the stores were to be used. In good times, they added to the reserve.
And so who were the leaders of this group?
Well, it's like any other society. There was a chief. He was the most respected man. And then there was the shaman, who was the spiritual leader. And he conducted the teaching and the local ceremonies, which they try to preserve, the ancient ceremonies. And they also, he was the doctor, but he was like a witch doctor.
Ah, yes. Okay.
He blew smoke on us to cure any ills. We had to sit and have him blow smoke on us. And we also found out that they did have an emergency radio to call out to the local agent if there was a real problem.
Hmm. And so how did Sean's essay go after he experienced all this?
Well, Sean continued. He said, "What did I learn? First of all, these people were much happier than we are at home. They worked and played in a friendly give and take. The community had a caring spirit of its own. They had no crime. They had no drugs. They had no need for a jail. They had no lawyers, no police, no firemen, no politicians, no bankers. They used no currency, but they bartered. They helped one another, and they loaned tools to one another. They shared food. They had closely knit families who demonstrated their affection by touching and hand-holding. And the children were encouraged. They had little to be jealous about, since they were all almost similar. They had very little differences between the haves and the have-nots. There was no upper 1%. They lived their values. Maybe they had a better life than we do." That was Sean's essay.
Wow, those are some deep insights. And how was his essay received at St. Paul's?
Oh, Sean was accepted at the St. Paul School, which, by the way, has over 43 buildings and over 2,000 acres on its campus to teach a total of 536 high school students.
Unbelievable.
I'll tell you more about the school. They have a 95,000 square foot athletic center.
Huge.
For 500 kids.
And how many students were in each class then with that many, that amount?
What's that?
How many students were there in each class then with that amount?
Oh, there was like 5 to 10 students in a class.
Oh.
The ratio was 5 students per teacher.
Wow.
At St. Paul. I'll tell you more about these private schools because there's a tremendous conflict. This story is a very interesting story because it highlights and puts a spotlight. It highlights and spotlights the differences in our society between the haves and the have-nots. We have an enormous gap that they don't have.
Right.
They are socially, economically very close to one another. We are socially, economically, significantly partitioned, if you will. And you think about the upper 1%. So there's a great moral lesson here.
Mm-hmm.
And these civilizations, by the way, have been analyzed and studied. This is nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
If you read about the American Indians, that's a good example that we lived in this country. A lot of Americans who were Europeans who were captured by the Indians wound up living with them and didn't want to come back to European society.
Yeah.
They liked the values. The Indians had wonderful values.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the same thing, the tribes, the same way as they have the tribes and the clans and the bands in different parts of the world today.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge lesson here.
Yeah, so tell us, Lewis. What are some of the lessons that you learned from this experience?
Well, the first thing you learn is that these communal groups have the same values, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
They have this commonality, this community feeling.
Right.
Everybody participates. So you go back to communism and Engels and Marx. This is different. Engels and Marx used to preach that communism was like these communities and it was ideal and everything was wonderful. This is not ideal. You don't want to have appendicitis here in the middle of the jungle.
Yeah, good point.
They have a radio to get them out. You don't want to have a toothache. They don't know how to treat that. You can't do mumbo-jumbo and spray smoke on people and hope that they're going to get well. So they have all kinds of growths, tumors, cancers, eye problems, glaucoma. They have skin problems, just like everybody else.
Yeah.
And they need treatment. And so they have a radio. And Peru, which is where these people are located, the government, they do have a government. It's not anarchy.
Exactly.
It's not every man for himself. And it's not total disregard for a structured life. They have a very structured life. and they have a representative from the Peruvian government visits them, and the girls are taken from the village very often into the major cities in Peru and taken to schools, put in convents, educated, taught women's rights, the right to divorce. They don't know about that stuff.
Right.
They don't know about women's rights. Did women do what they're told? No one has written anything about women's rights in rural tribes, in remote tribes. There are tribes in Brazil, in Guyana, in Peru, in Mexico, just some of them. I found over 80 tribes just in Suriname and French Guyana.
Oh, wow.
And
just
in
there.
Guyana.
It's a lot.
Right in that area.
Uh-huh.
80 tribes. And most of them, the government says, leave them alone. What happens is when they get contacted, they get exploited.
Mm-hmm.
The I named some of them, the Nanti, the Ma, the Muranashu, the Mashko, and the Piro tribes, all were decimated. 50% loss of their population when they were contacted by the outside world. 50%. What happens? Well, people go
diseases.
In there with diseases. Sure,
yeah.
And they get smallpox. And they get a lot of sexual diseases, syphilis and gonorrhea from the workers. They come in and they abuse the women. And they go in there. You have invaders like Shell, Dutch, you know, that's a Dutch company. Mobil, Exxon Mobil, that's American company. They go in there to drill oil. They don't care.
Yeah.
A lot of them go in to go for lumber. They lumber. So they go for the mahogany trees, and they decimate the thing.
Yeah.
We are losing 135 plant, animal, and insect species each day.
Wow.
Every single day.
That's so sad.
We are losing 80,000 acres of land to development.
Wow.
Of jungle land every day. Every day, 80,000 acres. That's crazy.
Yeah, it begs the question, when is it going to stop? And when are we going to lose the jungles and the wildlife?
Well,
it's horrible.
The tribes are still there in Africa, in the Pacific Islands, in the Philippines, in New Guinea, in Papua New Guinea. They're there, and they're being harassed. You take tourism, it's supposed to be wonderful. It's good. They're going to make all this money. They build a little house, and they open it up for people to come and visit them, and they perform dances and so on, and it's supposed to save their culture. It doesn't. It exposes them to all kinds of problems.
Yeah, I bet.
And in Peru, the government has a lot of programs. They have educational programs to try to help them. In Canada, they tried this integration, and they took the Inuit people in northwestern Canada. They're like the American Eskimos, and they tried to integrate them. They took their kids away, and they sent them to school, and they're going to teach them English, and they destroyed them.
Yeah,
the Canadian government is in the process of making reparations to the Native people.
That's not the way to do things.
No, it doesn't work.
No.
It's very interesting. It's a form of socialism, but it isn't really. Primitive life, they have no books, no hospitals. The childbirth, deaths in childbirth is high. Their life expectancy is low. They have no science, no math, no construction, no refrigerator, no disaster protection. It's not the easiest thing in the world. Have no need for banks,
right,
police, cars, lawyers, drugs. It's a trade-off.
Yeah, it's a tough balance because you think, okay, they're living in this sort of society, but then they're also missing in a society that's quite peaceful and enriching as far as like community and togetherness and all this. But then the other side of that coin is, you know, they're endangering their lives, the lives of their children, because they lack the health care and they lack these other resources and other opportunities.
We just take for granted the advances that we've made.
Yeah.
They haven't shared those advances.
Yeah.
So it's not a question of better than, it's different from.
Different from.
And I was just looking. Of course, they hunt and fish. They have these agricultural things. And then they, when the society gets more advanced, they go to agriculture from hunting and fishing, from the hunter-gatherers to agriculture. They have trouble with their neighbors. They get invaded. The tribes sometimes fight. They have rivalries. It's not so simple.
Yeah.
And there's no division of labor, and it's very the rich come in and try to exploit them. Always, it's always been that.
Yeah.
So we have there's no public transportation. There's no way of breaking out of the life they're in. They like it, but it's they don't. A lot of them don't have metal tools.
Wow.
So you see, for example, now. Some of the really remote tribes making contact with some of the tribes that are living on the rivers. So they come from the deep jungle, and they'll take a pot or a machete that's sitting around, and they'll come in at night, take it, and go away. And that's a contact. The people that study the relations between the tribes feel that that's a contact.
Yeah.
And that they're accepting something from them.
Huh.
And they have no contacts other than that. And they're deep in the jungle, and they put up spears, they don't cross spears on their paths, don't come any further. So they have a lot of problems. They have social classes. You become a priest that's a shaman, that's higher than a worker. It's not that simple.
Yeah, there's still a hierarchy.
Yeah.
Not everyone's equal.
But they're out for the minerals. We contacted them, and we go to be amused by them and to learn from them. So what do we learn from the whole thing? Well, to contrast it, take my grandson's schools and where he winds
up. Let's hear about that.
Well, I can tell you about that. There's a school in England, in West Palm Beach, called Oxbridge Academy in West Palm Beach. And it costs about $70,000 a year tuition for a kid.
Okay.
They have a full motion flight simulator for the kids, and they play horse polo. So each kid that is involved in a polo, you have to have a string of six polo ponies. And there are three high school programs in the country that have horse polo. I checked.
It's an expensive sport.
Colleges have a lot of polo. Cornell, I went down the stables there, and they were showing me the string of polo ponies that some of the kids had to play polo. You have to bring up at least six horses when you come up and feed them every day and have them groomed and cleaned and stable cleaned.
High maintenance.
Colleges with horse polo teams. And equestrian. There were 23 colleges I found with equestrian programs riding. And the Ivy League, Harvard, Yale, Brown, Cornell, and Princeton all have their own polo teams. That's very nice. Sean's school, I can tell you about that school. They have 95,000 square foot fitness center. They have 2,000 acres. They have two indoor hockey rinks. They have an 8-lane indoor swimming pool. They have 2,000-meter rowing course with a boathouse.
Wow.
They have 9 athletic fields. 9.
Wow.
For 500 kids. They have the ratio is 1-5. 5 students per professor. Almost 70% of the faculty have graduate degrees, some of them PhDs. Of the 200 and some odd students, 200, I think, graduated in 1 year. 54 went to Yale, 27 went to Harvard, 26 went to Brown, 26 went to Cornell, and 25 went to the University of Pennsylvania. These are prep schools preparing you for college. Mm-hmm. So you have, what are the big ones? Well, is Exeter, Phillips Exeter, Andover, Groton is a big Harvard. Groton supplies students to Harvard. Andover and Exeter supply students to Harvard. St. Paul's, where my grandson went, is a big source of students to Princeton, which is used to be a very snobbish school with eating clubs and so on. The way the old war, they were terrible. Groton supplies Harvard. Choate Rosemary Hall. Choate Rosemary Hall, they have 850 students. There's the classrooms don't have more than 11 kids, usually. If you don't prepare, you can't hide. They're going to call on you. They have indoor rowing. They have an indoor suspended track. They have 14 tennis courts, an indoor hockey rink, six athletic fields, a two-city block sports center. They have a great art center. You know, Paul Mellon went there. You know the Mellon Art Museum in Washington, D.C.? That's part of the National Museum of Art. Mm-hmm. He endowed that. That's I.M. Pei was the architect for one of the wings in Washington, D.C. of the National Museum.
Wow.
And paid for by the Mellon family. And they endow Choate Rosemary Hall, where my kids went to school. my two sons went there. And that school, I.M. Pei, designed and built the art center there, too. And they have their own dance center. And they have their... It's an amazing place. These people, and it's a little expensive, the tuition runs around in the $60,000 a year mark, $62,000, $66,000 in there. Lawrenceville the same way.
Wow.
Suffield Academy, St. Mark's, Deerfield Academy, Taft, the Pomfret Schools. I'm just mentioning some of the top schools. And these are the ones that send the kids that get into all the top fraternities and sororities. They go to Sigma Chi and Delta, 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 the ladies. And they get invited into Skull and Bones. And they become acceptable in society. Part of coming out in society is to be part of this socioeconomic group, the upper 1% I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And they get the jobs at Goldman Sachs when they come out of school and with the top law firms. They're offered clerkships with the judges. And the families are all interrelated and interconnected. And if you start out as a native in a village on a river with living in a wooden house, these people live in homes with servants, 10 bedrooms and 15 baths, and they're crazy. They have chauffeurs and help, and they don't know what being toughing it is. So the society is a enormous difference in between. We have the 1% and the people who are struggling and trying to go up the ladder. So in the Constitution, when they say all men are created equal, they aren't.
No.
They are not created equal. They are looked upon as equal in the eyes of the law, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
But if your uncle is the judge, and you're in front of your uncle, and they have a lot of rules that say the uncle doesn't have to disqualify himself. He can stay in as long as it's not closer than a brother or a sister. If it's a cousin, he can stay in. So that's what goes on, and it's a little disillusioning.
Yeah, there's definitely privilege, for sure.
So I think I've given you quite an insight and the trip up to the poor dolphin.
Up the river,
And they're getting extinguished. And so are these cultures, and we just run over them roughshod. And if we'd leave them alone, we'd be better off. And the world is suffering ecologically by the contacts that we're having and the attempts to capitalize and to exploit the natural resources. We're losing species and acreage every day.
We have to hold back on that. Wow, some really deep and some sad points that you pointed out, but thank you so much for sharing this juxtaposition that you were able to share with Sean, and Sean gained some really awesome insights for a young person, I think, right?
Yeah, he's now taking his second graduate degree in electrical engineering at Cornell. He has a master's in mechanical engineering and an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering. And
very impressive.
Hopefully he'll find a job.
Very impressive. You must be so proud.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. Thank you, Lewis. All right, can't wait until we chat next time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs, and be sure to pick up a copy of Lewis Ress's new book on Amazon.